And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. I'll remind you, we have a website, taylor-report.com, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Today we're going to do something really special. I'm very happy we're going to do it. We have in the studio with us Larry Krotz, who is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, and author of five previous books, including Midlife Man and Tourists, How Our Fastest-Growing Industry is Changing the World. Over the past 25 years, he has traveled to a number of African countries where he produced the documentary film Searching for Hawa's Secret and wrote extensively for magazines and newspapers on scientific research and foreign aid projects. He lives in Toronto. And Larry, welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So we're going to try something interesting. You've written a new book called The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, Outsiders in Africa. We've had you on before, and I've talked about this book. I think it's a very, very fine title because it covers something I care about a lot, which is the sort of assumption in our culture that everybody who sets out to go to Africa is helping out, and we are all behind them, and we all talk about how we should do more. It's on the front page of today's Globe and Mail. I'll probably at the end of all this ask you something about that. But at any rate, it's a terrific book. And what aspect of this book are you're going to do some reading for us today? So what is it you're going to go into?
Well, one of the stories that I covered both as a journalist over a period of a few years and then wrote about in the book is something that you're very close to.
Yeah.
International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which are the United Nations sponsored court that was set up to try those charged with
crimes against humanity
and various
generally
other
the word genocide hangs over
it
all
hangs over
every
it.
Case even if you weren't charged with it
but
it
in,
hangs
in the,
over the case.
in the aftermath of the awful events in Rwanda in the mid-1990s, the UN set up this court, which is still going on.
Almost two decades later,
At a cost of $100 million a year, paid for by the UN and all the contributor member countries, including Canada. And so what I'd like to do is, I sat in on one of the trials at the ICTR early in this decade. And where I want to take our audience today into, I guess, a little bit of a story about how the world runs.
Yes.
We'll try to find ourselves in the courtroom in Arusha watching this trial. Right. That's what I'm going to read.
That's something I always hoped would happen. So I'm really glad that you're here and going to do it.
Well, your audience should know as well that you're going to show up as a character in this because
walk across the set as a witness.
Because I'm sure people who follow your program week by week know that you've been involved in a number of those cases, and I think you're off in a month to be involved in.
I'm working one more case, as a matter of fact. Yes, and the element I always thought was missing was, and it's remarked on by many, is reportage and books, which actually go into the courtroom and let people know what happened. So I'm going to leave it to you.
All right.
This is Larry Krotz, from The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, Outsiders in Africa.
In 1998, journalist Philip Gurevich, a frequent writer for the New Yorker magazine, published a book. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. The title, certainly among the most chilling ever used for a work of nonfiction, was excerpted from a note Gurevich obtained from a 70-year-old Seventh-day Adventist pastor, the Reverend Elisaphan Ntakarudamana, who had fled from his village in the hills of southern Rwanda to Texas, where two of his children lived and where Gurevich tracked them down. On a tumultuous day in the spring of 1994, the note had been delivered to the pastor from a group of his church colleagues huddled inside the community hospital compound in a village called Muganero, and he had carried it with him ever since. The colleagues were all Tutsis, and Ntakarudamana was a Hutu. tribal names the whole world is now familiar with. The note, brought early in the morning to Ntakarutamana at his house by the community's sole policeman, was a plea from his colleagues for their lives. Their desperate hope was that he might have the power to save them. That he continued to keep it with him many months later, and after his flight from his country half a world away to the United States, was a reminder that he had failed. Later in the day in question, his colleagues were all killed, shot or butchered with machetes, along with a couple of hundred other people who cowered behind the walls of the Muvanero Hospital compound. The question, however, was whether he had simply failed to save his friends and colleagues, or was there something worse? While Ntakarutamana maintained that he had done what he could, to others, the note indicated something quite different. Within 24 hours of Gurevich paying his surprise visit in September 1996, Ntakarutamana was scooped up by FBI agents armed with an indictment from Louise Arbour, the Canadian newly instituted as prosecutor for the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He fought extradition from the United States, but lost. In due course, he was transported to a jail outside the Tanzanian town of Arusha, there to join another of his sons, Gerard, who had been a doctor at the Muvanero Hospital and had been arrested in Ivory Coast, where he had fled. The two were each charged with 3 counts of crimes against humanity and 3 counts of genocide. Nobody will ever dispute that in the spring and summer of 1994 in the tiny Central African country of Rwanda, unspeakable things happened. Close to 800,000 people, rounded off to 1 million in some histories, died. 1 in 8 of the country's population, in waves of rampant slaughter so horrible it stretches credulity to even try to imagine them. The killing was universal. It started in the capital of Kigali, but took place in every region of the country, in towns and rural villages and off in the bush. It was relentless, day after day after day, night after night, with those doing it reportedly falling down exhausted, grabbing a few hours of sleep to recuperate, and then recommencing their grisly enterprise. One reporter calculated that for the more than 3 months it went on, from April to July, 8,000 people would have had to be killed every day, day after day after day. But the most sobering thing about it is that it was all so intimate, accomplished not by smart bombs or gas chambers or even by rifles, but by machetes, clubs studded with spikes, and garden hoes, the most close-up and physical of means. It was not war, but murder. When the slaughter ended, there were 2 major questions, both of which have plagued the world ever since. What on earth caused this to happen? And what could or should have been done to prevent or stop it? On the first, there are theories running the full gamut from a carefully orchestrated genocide, complete with centralized planning and direction at one extreme, to, at the other, a proposition of chaos, ancient animosities run amok in the absence of social order. Among the first to die, in fact, were Hutu officials of moderate bent, like the president of the Constitutional Court and the Prime Minister. On the morning of April 7th, the Prime Minister, a 41-year-old former high school teacher who had young children and whose husband was a university administrator, subsequently killed also, was chased through the grounds of the United Nations Development Program compound, where she had fled from her own residence, and then butchered against the garden wall, while Belgian soldiers, who would themselves soon be killed, looked on impotent. The very first to die, in fact, was the Hutu president, Juvenal Habyarimana, whose dictatorship had run for 20 years, his plane shot out of the sky as it was returning to Kigali from neighboring Tanzania, where he had been forced into a meeting to agree to power sharing with his political enemies, the Tutsi-dominated Rwanda Patriotic Front. Genocide theorists argue that this plane crash was a prearranged signal to Hutu extremists to start the massacre, but in doing so, ignore the point that no one, except presumably the perpetrators, yet knows if the heat-seeking ground-to-air missile that brought down the president's plane was fired by Hutus of an extremist political party, by French paratroopers working on their behalf, or by RPF fighters. What you had, no matter which analysis you select, was an invading force, a dead president, established order collapsed. On the second question, of what the rest of the world could or should have done, hindsight has provided us with the luxury of conceiving numerous strategic courses. The objective fact, shamefully undeniable, is that in the immediacy of the events, the outside world did virtually nothing. The United Nations Security Council ordered the small contingent of international peacekeepers already on the ground in Kigali, headed by Canadian General Roméo Dallaire, to follow its initial mandate, which was to monitor only, and ignored his pleas for a beefing up of his support and a freeing of his hand to undertake some kind of action. Any action. France and Belgium, who had soldiers in Kigali, as well as lengthy histories of enmeshment with the Habyarimana regime, will have to examine their own consciences. These things said, one might nevertheless wonder what a few outsiders, performing as international soldiers, could possibly have achieved in terms of stemming such violence as occurred, even were their forces doubled, or tripled, or quadrupled. And the answers to all such questions are doomed to remain forever in the realm of the speculative. What also has to be confronted, of course, is the nightmarish sociological or psychological question. What exists inside human beings that can cause them to become turned from people who have lived their entire lives peacefully, going about their family and community business, being husbands, fathers, sons, daughters, neighbors, into the active killers so many of them would have had to become in order for this to transpire on the scale it did? How did they enter into such madness and sustain their fury over so many frenzied days and weeks? Tribal or ethnic or caste identities, even ancient grudges aside, what on a purely human level could have brought, in the case of Pastor Ntakarudamana, a 70-year-old man, pastor in a Christian church, father of five grown and educated and accomplished children, a man who had dedicated all the labors of his life to securing his position, and then his second eldest son, not long back from medical training in the United States, married with three small children of his own, to this place where they should be hunted halfway across the world and then charged with having committed the most heinous and terrible crimes known to man. The charges stated that they had participated in an attack on men, women, and children who had taken refuge in the Muganero hospital complex. In ensuing days, they had searched for and attacked Tutsi survivors and others, killing and causing serious bodily or mental harm. What kind of person could become unhinged, if you will, from the proper, sedate, responsible life they by all accounts have been living, and undertake such deeds as they were accused of? And then, what kind of person would remain after it was over? When I first saw the Ntakarudamanas, father and son, it was through a bulletproof glass wall. In the end, what the outside world had done was set up a court. Chastened by the world media and the scale of what they eventually realized had happened in Rwanda, the United Nations Security Council in 1996 issued a directive to establish the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, its task to put on trial those fingered as instrumental to the Rwandan atrocities. In total, only about 70 got named, all high-level people, generals, cabinet ministers, bishops, mayors, police officials, among whom the Ntakarudamana, son and father, a lowly pastor and country doctor, couldn't help but think, seemed the least. In the autumn of 2001, 7 years after the massacres in their homeland, 5 years after Gerard's arrest in Ivory Coast, and a year after the pastor had been extradited from the United States, their UN-sponsored trial began in Arusha, Tanzania. On a bright morning in early May 2002, I surrendered my camera and deposited my driver's license with the security intake desk at the Arusha International Conference Center. "Don't worry," laughed the guard, a jolly man of substantial girth, as he handed me a laminated visitor's badge. "You will get them back." The conference center, had originally been donated to Tanzania by the government of China for use as a regional trade facility for local agricultural products, but now had been commandeered by the UN and converted into a courthouse complex. Complex is a good word, for it would be hard to describe the sum of the center using other terminology. The whole of the place was made up of three buildings labeled Kilimanjaro, Serengeti, and Ngorongoro. These, connected by walkways, tunnels, and bridges, in any one of which I realized quickly it was possible to get hopelessly lost. A guard in shiny polished boots told me I was in Kilimanjaro when I needed to be in Serengeti. In a stairwell, obviously going in the wrong direction, I encountered someone who worked for the court, an Indian woman. She turned me around, muttering, "This building is sick." Finally, I made it. On first impression, Trial Chamber 3 resembled not so much any sort of courtroom I might have been used to, as it did a theater stage, or set for a television program. There has to be a standard blueprint for the courtrooms the UN constructs for its trials. I had been to the one in The Hague, created inside a former insurance company office building for the accused from former Yugoslavia, and it was exactly the same. The layout, rather than front to back, ran side to side. Perhaps 30 feet deep, the room was easily four times that in width. At the back, on a raised blonde wood dais next to the blue UN flag, sat three big black leather chairs waiting for the tribunal of judges. Facing them, rather than the prosecution team or the defense team as you would have in a North American or British courtroom, was a table for the witnesses. The prosecutors and defenders were to the sides, facing one another, though oblique to both the judges and the witness. The prosecutors to the extreme left of the judges and, like boxing the square, the defenders to the extreme right. Behind the defense sat their clients, and back of both groups was all the paraphernalia, not so much of justice as of production. Hidden by smoked glass windows behind the prosecutors was a translation team for the converting of the proceedings into simultaneous French, English, and Kinyarwandan. Back of the defense team and behind where the defendants sat between burly guards were technicians who controlled television cameras to transmit the proceedings to monitors set in the spectators' gallery. This gallery, which I had entered, was a parallel room of similar size and similar configuration, but separated from the courtroom by the wall of bulletproof glass. It was furnished with 75 plush theater seats in three rows. Fixed to each was an outlet for a headset to listen to the proceedings in the language of choice, and an easy view of each was one of the several TV monitors. I took a seat among only five visitors that morning and discovered I was right in front of a dripping air conditioner. I moved a few seats over. I quickly found that you didn't need the TV monitors. It was easily possible to watch everything live. Through the glass, you could plainly see the judges and at oblique angles both the defense and prosecution as well as the defendant between his guards. If you wanted a better view of anything or anybody, you just moved a row or two over as necessary. The person who would not be so visible, however, was the witness, always with his or her back to the spectators, and, if it was a sensitive witness, as a number were, they would be hidden completely behind a drawn green curtain. Then, the screens as well would go blank. It was just before 9 in the morning. On the other side of the glass, things were bustling. Clerks carried files, and prosecutors flapped about in their dark gowns. Across from them huddled the lawyers for the defense. It was truly an international cast. Checking into the trial, I'd learned that the prosecution team was made up of a Nigerian, a Tanzanian, and an American. The tribunal of judges, not yet present, were from Norway, Senegal, and South Africa. The defense lawyers, who I had already met, were David Jacobs from Toronto and Ramsey Clark from New York. Through a door at the back, escorted by their guards and looking a bit confused, even as they were greeted by their lawyers, entered two men I realized had to be the defendants. They were not quite what I had expected. The pastor was quite natty in a dark business suit and gold-rimmed spectacles. Gerard, the doctor, looked portly despite his 5 years of prison food and wore large plastic glasses of an aviator style, It had the effect of making him look a bit bug-eyed and overly intense. They did not look like men who had come from dusty hill country villages and then spent years languishing in the clamorous boredom of a Tanzanian jail. The pastor, however, I noted, on second take, did appear a bit feeble, as he had to be helped to his seat by the guard. He was by this time, after all, 78 years old. Also, the heat of the African summer notwithstanding, he was chilly. Under his suit jacket, he had on a wine-colored sweater. At 9 o'clock, the clerk barked some intonation in French, and everyone stood. In solemn procession, in trooped the judges. They struck a careful balance, not just in the countries they were from, but also in mix of gender. Two women, one man. Race, one black African, one white European, and one Indian. And judicial tradition, one from a common law tradition, the other two from the civil tradition. In their flowing black robes and brilliant red sashes, however, they resembled nothing so much as wildly exotic birds. The trial, having started the previous autumn, was half over. The prosecution had made its case, and now it was the turn of the defense, which is what interested me. The trials going on here, like those for Yugoslav accused proceeding simultaneously in The Hague, were the progeny of the Nuremberg war crimes trials at the end of the Second World War. In the dock in front of us were reputedly the most awful people in the world, which raised the question, was there any defense to be made? Back in Toronto, an educated, presumably civilized woman I had been telling about where I was going and why had made the comment they should just stand them up against a wall and shoot them, which was not an uncommon view. So despicable were the crimes the defendants were accused of that otherwise reasonable people lost the perspective it had taken millennia of civilization to impart. The vengeful urge for instantaneous punishment threatened to overwhelm the careful requirements for due process. Yet, legal principles adhered to by much of the world expected not only due process, but a presumption of innocence until proven otherwise. I had to wonder, would there truly exist possibilities for those here? How hard would it be to prevent this from becoming a kangaroo court? Elementary justice also provided every accused with the right to a defense, which is again what interested me. How would you organize a defense in such a case as in such cases as these? How would you go about finding your witnesses? Could people without fear speak up with the truth, especially if it went against the perceived wisdom? Likewise, I wanted to know, if you were a defense lawyer, what would it be that motivated you? To be the prosecutor, given the world mood by this point vis-a-vis Rwanda, would be the easy option. A lawyer on the defense side would have to be brave. So what sort of people were attracted to that? Were they idealists, rebels, iconoclasts? When people found out that you had taken on the job, how did they react to you? And beyond that, what would it be like to defend such cases? Surely the dastardliness of the deeds one's clients were accused of must weigh heavily. Therefore, not only how did you strategize in law for your defense, but how did it feel to defend such people? Loaded with such questions, I searched the website for the court where I eventually located David Jacobs. A number of lawyers on both the prosecution and defense sides were Canadians, possibly because of the matter of language, Rwanda's official European language being French. Jacobs was one such Canadian. I called him up and made an appointment to see him in Toronto. His office was in a working class and heavily ethnic section of the city. Downstairs was a Portuguese restaurant. He ushered me into a small corner office where both of us negotiated our way across a floor littered with briefcases, traveling bags and stacks of transcripts and papers. Jacobs had never done any international trial before, having inherited this case when Gerard and Takarudamana's first lawyer had become ill. But since then, he had thrown himself into the project, juggling his Canadian workload so much that he was worried lest it might suffer. He was easy to talk to, had bountiful opinions, and no hesitancy about taking the time to bring a visiting stranger up to speed with what was going on as of the moment. He had not been involved very long, but it was long enough, I learned quickly, for him to have become frustrated. Though this was our first meeting, we talked for a long time about a litany of complaints he had about everything from how the defense was viewed in the UN court system to practical problems like getting access to witnesses and getting paid. One sore point was the way defense lawyers who tapped in for the remuneration to a kind of UN legal aid system were expected to carry their own sizable expenses while waiting for the UN to process their bills. Jacobs told me he'd had to mortgage his house to give him sufficient cash to keep paying for his trips back and forth to Africa to see his client and attend court. Eventually, I looked at my notebook and spotted the question I'd underlined as important to ask, if only to get it out of the way. Finally, I broached it. When you are a defense attorney, two things are possible, I said. Either you've got guilty clients, but you represent them because that's what our system demands, or you believe your client is innocent. Which is it here? These men, Jacob stated flatly, didn't do the acts they're accused of. The Ntakarutimana defense team was registered at the Ilboro Safari Lodge in Arusha. Though not by any stretch fancy, it was indeed a pleasant place, a series of thatched huts set amongst flower beds and renting for about $50 a night. On Sunday morning, I entered the dining room to find Ramsey and Georgia Clark alone at breakfast. I introduced myself and they shifted over so I could join them. A television, perched on one of the tables, was tuned to CNN and was broadcasting the French elections. Ramsey Clark was 74 years old, 4 years younger than his client, the pastor. He'd had a lengthy career starting more than 40 years earlier as something of a wonder kid in American law and politics. His father, from Texas, had been a Supreme Court justice appointed by Truman. Then, in the 1960s, with the election of John F. Kennedy, young Ramsey got a position as assistant to the president's brother, the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy. When Lyndon Johnson took the place of the assassinated JFK, he asked Clark himself to become Attorney General, a position from which he was to guide far-reaching and even revolutionary civil rights propositions into law. During those years, the Clarks were at the epicenter of Washington action and power. Georgia Clark, who now in her 70s and married to Ramsey for 53 years, still looked, with long hair falling over her shoulders, like an unreconstructed hippie, told a little anecdote about having danced with John Kenneth Galbraith. In the decades since, however, much had changed. Clark's liberalism and passion for civil liberties had carried him into worlds ever further removed from the predictable safety of the conventional. He had become associated with the quixotic, some say odious, causes, like the legal plight of former Yugoslav strongman Slobodan Milosevic, Liberian dictator Charles Taylor, and Saddam Hussein, who he had visited a number of times in Iraq in those days well before the U.S. invasion of that country. I was naturally intrigued. When you sat down with Saddam Hussein, I asked, what did you talk about? Clark looked at me. Saddam was very interested in Lyndon Johnson, he answered. Though not so much his presidency as his earlier career in Texas, when he had been instrumental in the whole issue of rural electrification. One of Saddam's achievements had been to deliver electric power to the back corners of Iraq, and he felt that by having done so, he and Johnson shared something in common. One by one, the rest of the defense team arrived for breakfast. David Jacobs, Phil Taylor, Cynthia Hernandez, and Morris and Sabimama. Immediately, they settled into a kind of impromptu meeting. Though it was Sunday, there was a great deal of work to be done to prepare for the resumption of the trial the next morning, and they had a full day planned, including a meeting with their clients, the pastor and the doctor, out at the prison on the edge of town. The next morning, in court, Phil Taylor slid into the chair beside me in the visitor gallery. The pastor himself in what would be an all-day affair, had taken the stand, and Ramsey Clark was taking him through the entire period of his life. He'd been born in a grass hut, he testified, but had been fortunate to fall under the care of the missionaries who had made sure he got some schooling. Taylor, wiry and red-haired, had grown up in California and served in the U.S. Marine Corps. Now he lived in Toronto and struck me right off as a kind of character you might find in some Dashiell Hammett story. While the prosecution had all the machinery of international police and justice at their fingertips, the defense had to scramble to get their evidence and their witnesses. To assist in their investigations, or to even have investigations, they had to turn to freelance investigators like Taylor, who they knew could operate with moxie and inventiveness, not to mention on the cheap. While the judges and prosecutors were UN employees collecting United Nations salaries, each defense counsel was paid from an international legal aid fund that had definite limits to it. Bringing to mind Kafka's observation about the defense being not so much a right as what the system tolerates. The prosecution staff had generous housing allowances and business-class airplane tickets to ferry them back and forth to Europe. But people like Taylor lived in flea-bag hotel rooms out of suitcases. Or sometimes not. On this trip, he had arrived at the airport back in Toronto too late, and the agent had refused to accept his luggage. He was making do with only what he had carried on and newly purchased items like t-shirts and jeans he had managed to pick up from vendors in the streets of Arusha. Yet he appeared to thrive, both in the lifestyle and on the challenges. He had worked for several of the Rwanda defense lawyers, in the process coming to know as much about Central Africa as anybody. His main job was to line up witnesses, which involved finding them, checking their stories, and then making sure they showed up and were kept safe during their time at the trial. A task that, again for the defense side of things, came off as immeasurably more difficult than it was for the prosecution. Taylor added to the skepticism already prevalent among the defense group about the potential guilt of their clients. Like Jacobs and Clark, he had a hard time accepting the pastor as somebody possessing such deep passions that he could have perpetrated the lurid crimes of which he was accused. He was a real church guy, he told me in a protesting voice. The defense, at least in this case, not only believed the narrative of their clients, they did more. They bought into the Hutu version of Rwandan history. In the aftermath of the events of 1994, fed substantially by such reportage as Philip Gourovitch's book, conventional wisdom about Rwanda had gelled promptly and with a uniform analysis. Genocide had happened, Tutsis were victims, Hutus were evil. The power of this take overwhelmed all reporting out of Rwanda and was responsible for creating the exalted platform from which the United Nations now presumed to dispense its justice. Without denying that horrible things had happened and that hundreds of thousands lay dead, the defense and their acolytes not only required but actually espoused an infinitely more nuanced version, one they seemed to believe passionately would be vindicated by history. As for myself, as a writer, I knew I was caught in the middle and needed to approach these highly charged matters warily. For the most part, I was desperately interested to find out what kind of world the accused in front of me, the people being defended in such a dedicated manner by Jacobs and Clark, were coming from. What, for example, did Taylor mean by describing the pastor as a real church guy? The Seventh-day Adventist Church was founded in 1863 by a small group of zealous Christians who believed, among other things, that the Sabbath ought to be observed on Saturday. Today, it boasts 10 million members in 229 countries. Decidedly not what one might call mainstream, it is still one of the fastest-growing Christian churches in the world, known for aggressive missionary work accompanied by construction of hospitals and schools in such places as Rwanda. And for people like the Intakarutamanas, it had provided earthly as well as spiritual salvation. Although he had been born poor in a grass hut, the pastor had the fortune to be absorbed at an early age into the circle of this church. Eventually, he became one of the first generation of black Africans to take charge of its local leadership. Through his long life, it seemed, he had applied himself to his job, kept his nose clean, and by the time he was 60, had become a supervising official, a position of considerable local status, with three of his own children trained as doctors. Yet, that life, by all accounts, was far from grand. The Adventists are conservative, modest, and pious. In no country, including Rwanda, is it axiomatic that they are part of the power structure in the ways Catholic or Anglican churches and officials might be. They reputedly disdain politics. The pastor, whether you went by the accounts of others or simply observed him in court, was a stern, uninteresting man. Not so much a church leader in the charismatic or political sense as the prosecution liked to paint him. But, as Taylor had tried to explain, a fastidious bean counter. When he was put in charge of 34 churches, a hospital, and a couple of schools, Taylor told me, his main task was to keep the books. As Clark took him through the events of his life, he explained how the church consumed his life. Each morning he traveled to a simple office, got on his knees for a lengthy period of prayer, then spent the rest of the long day making sure the church's machinery was efficiently and honestly run. Which raised for me the same skepticism it had for Jacobs, Clark, and Phil Taylor. Where, one had to wonder if this was the case, was there room or time or inclination for the almost unthinkable deeds he was accused of? I looked at the pastor, what I could see of him in the witness chair with his back to the visitor's gallery, but with his face playing on the television screens. I had been brought a copy of the indictment, and I read over the list of accusations. Did he and his son really do these things? And then, if they had done even some of them, what was there? Evil? Cowardice? I found it perplexing. Where was truth? Who had actually done what or mandated what? With Rwanda, it seemed perfectly possible to believe either or both sides, with all the dead bodies square in the middle. At noon, the court broke for lunch. I decided to take the break as an opportunity to explore. I thought I could seek out the United Nations Public Relations Office and pick up some material about the court. I didn't have to go that far. Mounting a walkway, I passed a wall loaded with the United Nations promotional material. On large posters were explanations in English and French of what lay behind the tribunal. The mandate, Resolution 955 of the Security Council, a definition of genocide, an explication of the trial chambers and the appeals court, how judges who could apply from any member state were elected to four-year terms, how the prosecutor at the time, Carlo Del Ponte, an Italian, worked out of offices in Arusha and Kigali, the Rwandan capital. There was a prominently displayed message from the registrar, Adama Dieng, of Senegal, saying, "Justice is no longer local, it is going global." Then a final poster citing the achievements of the ICTR, itemizing how it had arrested more than 70 individuals and convicted the Prime Minister, Jean Kambanda, the first time for head of government. In all, it all added up to one overwhelming message. This was not a court like any other. What other court in the world, I thought, would dare mount a public relations campaign that boasted of its overwhelming conviction rate? Like the extension of some police department, the tribunal gave off an irrefutable sense of its own certainty. It had the bad guys and needed only to go through the motions. Back upstairs in the spectators' gallery, I settled in for the afternoon and commenced chatting with the person occupying the next chair, an Irish woman with a great pad of paper on her knee, Rosemary Byrne. Byrne told me that she was a law professor who directed something called the International Process and Justice Project at Trinity College, Dublin, and had been coming to the trial every day. Both as an academic and a jurist, she had an abundance of interest in how this court was working. In The Hague, the UN was moving at that very moment to set up an international criminal court that would be permanent. But there was a multitude of questions about how it would work. Even basic questions had not yet been settled, such as which legal traditions it might work from. A court, after all, being nothing if not the embodiment of the mores and traditions of the community over which it presides. In a sense, this tribunal appeared to be serving as a kind of dry run for the oncoming permanent court. Its strengths would be noted, but so would its mistakes, hopefully not to be repeated. Another important thing for a court is consistency and predictability. And to this end, Rosemary Byrne was watching the interactions between the counsel and the judges. I could see her pen scribble whenever one happened. She recorded objections, interruptions, motions. Most interjections originated from the Norwegian judge, Mr. Mose. So far, Judge Mose's colleagues, the two women, Judge Pillay from South Africa and Andrija Vaz from Senegal, had not uttered a word. There were three tribunals operating simultaneously, and according to Byrne, their flavor and effectiveness depended entirely on the personnel selected to staff them. There was a vast difference one to the next, largely dependent on the nationality and judicial traditions of those participating. A court needed to be run with a firm and fair hand. If it weren't, all kinds of chaos could erupt and carry things either into farce or danger. There had been an example of this a few days earlier in this very courtroom. A skirmish, after which the defense had filed a motion alleging prosecutorial misconduct. For the incident in question, the witness had been a young Adventist preacher, the star, Phil Taylor told me, of their church. The problem came when the Nigerian prosecutor rose to cross-examine. Within minutes, he was accusing the witness of lying about his identity, and then of being wanted for raping three women. Objections flew fast and furious. No corroborating evidence was offered, and the judges intervened to ask what kind of fishing expedition the prosecutor might be on. Ramsey Clark was near apoplectic. "Your Honor, this is the most unprofessional cross-examination I have ever heard," he fumed. The problem, however, quickly became even more complicated. In the gallery that afternoon was a reporter from internewsallafrica.com, and by supper time the story had flashed back to Rwanda and the rest of Africa. Defense witness wanted in Kigali for genocide, prosecutor alleges. This sent the defense into paroxysms, not only about the surprise, but what they believed were absurd allegations. This sent the defense into paroxysms, not just about the surprise and what they believed were absurd allegations, but about what the broadcast would mean for the safety of their witness and his family hidden away in an Arusha safe house. Despite the fact that witness identities were kept carefully secret, back in their place of exile and back in Rwanda, people would put two and two together and know immediately who they were. When they contacted people to be witnesses, Phil Taylor told me, the first thing they ask is for confirmation they will be safe. A few days later, a second issue highlighting the clash of traditions came up. The prosecutors produced a statement allegedly from an 83-year-old woman who had traveled with the Ntakaruta Manas during their flight from Rwanda. She was a witness neither for the prosecution, who argued she was too old and too ill, nor for the defense, who, as Taylor explained, couldn't expose her to the risk of calling her out of Kigali, where she now lived. But in 1995, investigators had questioned her and produced notes, which the prosecutor now introduced. A brouhaha erupted, with Jacobs jumping up to object to the statement being submitted as if testimony. "It's just a bunch of words on paper," Ramsey Clark protested. After a hasty conference, the judges ruled to allow the statement. I looked over at Rosemary Byrne, who was scribbling furiously. At the break, I asked her what it all meant. "If this were a jury trial," she said, "this would be very prejudicial. Here, though," she went on, "it seemed to be a pattern for judges to allow pretty much everything, because they'll be the ones making the ultimate judgment. In the year 2000, during the last summer of his presidency, Bill Clinton traveled to Africa. It was in many respects a journey of contrition, as well as, arguably, the beginning of what turned into a new round of big power G8 concern about whither Africa. Wanting to try to get things started with a clean slate, Clinton expressed careful regrets about slavery that had taken so many Africans forcefully to the Americas, and, as well, stated his regrets about Rwanda. Then he visited Arusha. Given a tour of the ICTR and duly impressed with this symbol of international judicial effort, the U.S. President correspondingly pronounced Arusha the Geneva of Africa. Though local officials wasted no time getting the presidential phrase printed as a slogan on the outside wall of the International Conference Center, Tanzanians in general might have been less certain they wanted to be so compared. One wag mused as to whether the inverse could ever happen, a sign in Geneva calling it the Arusha of Europe. But the significant thing is that whenever something so substantial comes to or is imposed on a community, a number of questions naturally open up, and Arusha was no exception. Every day in the white Chevrolet, which our driver Ibrahim kept immaculately clean and maintained, we would bump down the road from our hotel. First we would pass through our immediate neighborhood, people and goats and huts and shops all impinging on the broken up and potholed road. Then turn on the main thoroughfare and head into town for a session of the court. If it were in America or Britain, Arusha would be called a farming town. It had long been a market center for a region where crops of coffee, maize, and wheat were grown on the sunny plain shaded by the towering Mount Meru and just beyond the shadow of Kilimanjaro. The sprawling game grounds of the Serengeti and Ngorongoro craters stretched to the west, attracting their throngs of tourists. The local people, however, were not great fans of the game animals. Game animals threatened to either trample their crops or eat them. Rather than the tourist hotels, what they prized was their local economy and its symbol in their community, the International Conference Center donated to Tanzania and Arusha by the friendly government of China. Yet it was this that they had now lost. When the UN blew into town, some locals, like Ibrahim, had benefited, at least economically. By opting to go into business, hiring himself and his car, he and his wife had prospered. Abraham was a devout Christian, yet so industrious and conscientious was he that even on a Sunday morning on his way to church, he would call by to deliver whoever of his clients needed a lift. But though he personally had benefited from the influx of the outsiders, as he had watched the town changed, he remained far from certain it was all for the general good. With the UN coming, he said, prices for everything had immediately shot skyward, housing costs going up by as much as 500%. As Arusha became the Geneva of Africa, it had turned for many of its own citizens into an alien, more expensive place. The changes wrought by the arrival of the ICTR were both social and economic. By importing a large staff, the project had increased the local population. It had funneled money into the community. The United Nations was spending almost $100 million a year on the tribunal. And though not all of this cash remained in Arusha by any means, even the salaries of most of the people based there was probably banked back in their home countries, enough stuck to make an impact. The predominant theory about economic benefit in such cases is the trickle-down one. The people bringing in money spend it, and those receiving it in the first round from them then spend it yet again. In a cycle of diminishing, though ever more widely spread increments, the money makes its way through the economy, its impact being felt several times over. Ibrahim and the hotel staff at the Oburu benefited without question. The dozens of locals who had been hired as guards and secretaries and groundskeepers, drivers and cleaners at the court complex, likewise benefited. Some did substantially well. There were Tanzanian lawyers and the prosecutorial staff, for example, pulling world-level salaries. All the places these people went to do their shopping benefited. However, the accompanying theory to the trickle-down one is the inflationary theory. And here, for the community at large, as Abraham had pointed out, the economic effect was arguably as disruptive as it was beneficial. What did it mean if you managed to get some kind of job, but everything you were accustomed to purchasing now cost 5 times what it had previously? What did it mean if you had to pay these prices without benefiting from having received a job? Similarly, the social effects had the potential to be disruptive. The ICTR had several hundred employees, some of them local, but a good many imported, either on a long-term basis, like the sitting judges and their families, or on a rotating transient basis, like the defense lawyers. Both of these groups created disruption in the existing social structure. Arusha already had a black Tanzanian and an Asian or East Indian elite in its local political and business structure. But like the arrival in the past of colonial governors and their hangers-on, the UN lathered on a new or additional elite. The judges, prosecutors, and upper-level UN officials possessed both high incomes and high status. They would either infiltrate the existing elite and possibly with their numbers overwhelm it, or more likely in failing that, they would become a parallel, competing elite. The foreign employees, especially at the top levels of judges and prosecutors with high salaries and generous expense allowances, hived themselves off into the kinds of expatriate suburban enclaves every African city has in one form or another. Rented villas with walls and security gates. Limitless domestic staffs of cooks and gardeners and night guards. They and their families could be seen booting about town, chauffeured by their hired drivers. In short order, a chasm between them and all but the thinnest upper crust of local society followed as they demanded and were provided with their own schools for their foreign children, their own clubs and restaurants catering to a kind of money they had to spend, their own life. Many African cities have such enclaves of foreigners, but Arusha had so many high-level UN people who had arrived all so abruptly, it had caused a substantial impact. At mid-afternoon, I arrived back at court. I was cleared through security and made my way up to the spectators' gallery of Chamber 3. When I got to my seat, the pastor was on the stand with Ramsey, leading the questions. They were moving close in the chronological sequence of things to April 16th, the fateful day laid out in the charges filed against the Ntakarutamanas, and the fateful day in the pastor's entire life. It was slated to be a traumatic episode of testimony. But just before they could get into it, the pastor waved his hand and was taken to the toilet. When he returned, Ramsey Clark introduced the morning of April 16th and asked him to recall what had happened. It was 5:30. Not yet dawn, the pastor testified. I was still in bed. Gendarmes rang the bell at my gate. The national police, 4 of whom had been at the mission compound for several days, brought 2 letters, one for him personally and one for him to take to the burgmaster or local mayor. Clark asked him to read his letter. Taking a minute, he unfolded a piece of paper and began to read in Kinyarwandan. Into my headset came the English translation. Our dear leader, Pastor Elisafan Ntakarutamana, how are you? From then on, not quite the exact words of Gurevich's title, but close. With our children replaced with our families. And instead of help, the word compassion was what God, in their words, had bestowed upon the pastor. Upon asking for his intervention to save their lives, they thanked him in advance. But the great difference between what we heard in court and the story in the book was the pastor's reply. After a futile trip to the burgmaster, Ntakarutamana penned a reply to his doomed brethren, which in his testimony was worded, "In conclusion, you are in God's hands. Which was different, it occurred to me, in the response gathered from hearsay accounts in Philip Gourevitch's travels throughout Rwanda. God no longer wants you. There was a moment of silence in the room, on both sides of the bulletproof glass. The pastor was then asked to go through the 7 signatories to the letter, recounting his relationship with each. Every eye in the courtroom and spectators' gallery was on him. He began in a faltering voice. This one taught me. This one was under my authority. I taught him. This one had a sickly wife, and I took him to work. He removed his glasses and brought a handkerchief to dab his eyes. It was a difficult moment. An elderly man naked with his memories. Either the man before us, I thought, is the most shameless and accomplished of actors, or his story has to be believed. Once the pastor had composed himself, Clark asked him how he felt when he read the letter the first time, on the morning 8 years earlier. That letter shattered me, he testified. I didn't know how to conduct myself. I started trembling. The story goes on, but our time does not go on. But perhaps, Phil, you can tell how this trial ended.
I was waiting for the judges to enter. Listen, first of all, I got to thank you. That took a lot of steam, didn't it? This is a warm room, and thank you. For me, of course, it's I go back through it, kind of like revisiting a small nightmare, I guess. It's very accurate from my memory of all those things. By the way, let me just tell everybody, we're speaking to Larry Krotz. He is the author of The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, Outsiders in Africa, and in this book he devotes considerable attention to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and describing a case in which Ramsey Clark was the lead counsel for Pastor Takubirimana. I happen to be an investigator. And, of course, the final judgment that he was convicted, as was his son, was appealed. Most of the charges against him were not found to be... He wasn't found guilty then, but there were a sufficient number. And one judge, I recall, particularly had the attention, was interested in why he hadn't flown to the rescue of people who were being assaulted by a mob. And rather than was he leading the mob, I mean, at reading that book of Gourevitch and your account indicates that the picture of him when he was captured was that he was the leader. That really isn't the way it was concluded before.
It'd be very hard to conclude that from looking at him, too.
He's not much of an athlete, nor a leader in the sense of political person. Yeah. Actually, it's interesting to kind of discontinue to turn it over as a subject. When we first read the account of him, the prosecutor said that he was a party leader of an identifiable political party, an important one. That never came out. That was never part of anybody's testimony because he wasn't. But, if people, it's the old problem. You read a newspaper headline the first day and you think awful things.
You're accused of something. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to transcend that.
Yeah.
And you might tell your audience that the pastor died.
Yes, he's died. He never got home. He had served his time. It was clear the court did not have the same picture of him they had had or the prosecutor had presented, and he eventually was released into a sort of halfway house position in Arusha. His family was in Laredo, Texas, but the United States would not allow him to return to his family. He did, of course, return in a box. He was buried in Laredo. has had, by the way, the wife, his widow, has also expired in the past few months, actually, not that long ago. And the son, Dr. Gerard, has just been transferred from Arusha, Tanzania, to Benin, where he will serve out his time, which is... And it's a story, I think it will be revisited. I want to thank you for your book. I'm glad you came to Tanzania, but I think that we started off today talking about history books. I mean, this is one of those matters which is going to be gone over, and frankly, there's a lot to go over. there has not been much coverage.
No, the historians are at work on it as we speak.
Yes, but not enough authors. We need more reporting, and it's been quite sketchy. I want to thank again Larry Cross for coming. And the book is The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, Outsiders in Africa. It's a terrific book, and I hope people will get a copy. And we hope to see Larry again. And thanks again for coming.
Great to be here.
That's it for the Taylor Report. Thanks a lot, Eric.